This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, what may be remembered as an historic conference on the Black radical tradition was held at Temple University in Philadelphia this past weekend, from January 8th through the 10th. Many hundreds of activists from all across the country gathered to review the experiences of the current grassroots mobilization against police violence and to put it in perspective with past Black movements in the United States and the fight against predatory capitalism worldwide. The conference was titled Reclaiming Our Future, the Black Radical Tradition in Our Time. It was put together largely by students, activists, and organizers from Philadelphia and keynoted by speakers including Angela Davis, Cornel West, and Anthony Monteiro. An extraordinary panel discussion unfolded under the title Challenging White Supremacy, the Black Radical View. Umi Saleh, formerly known as Philip Agnew of the Florida-based Dream Defenders, presented a devastating critique of those whose claim to leadership is based on the size of their Twitter followings, most notably DeRay McKesson of Campaign Zero. Saleh called social media an asylum for neoliberal values and described McKesson's political leanings as counter-revolutionary and anti-movement. He began his critique this way.
As we have heard, white supremacy is a disease. It is recalcitrant. It is resistant to most forms of treatment. As with patriarchy and capitalism, it is a chameleon, a toxin able to infect its hosts silently, often misdiagnosed as ego or religion, tradition, or ignorance. White supremacy is highly contagious. It has been known to be transmitted orally in the venomous caustic cancer of the tongue, so watch your language. It has been known to be transmitted through skin-to-skin contact, in the loveless embrace, or in the domestic fist, or in the cold shoulder to the community. So watch everything you build and keep moist towelettes handy. I've even heard that it can be transmitted in the water and in the air and spread telepathically. I heard that if one happens to touch one afflicted with the illness and then one happens to rub one's eye, it can render one's vision distorted or blinded or even worse, colorblind. I've heard that this disease even attacks our dead, condemning and convicting our corpses, guard the graves. You get the picture. White supremacy is a motherfucker. Alas, as brothers West and Monteiro reminded us, it is one that the Black radical tradition has wrestled with for centuries. And as this panel implies, it is a motherfucker that calls us, especially today, to remain ever vigilant and war ready. Today, I'd like to speak of a particularly pervasive symptom of white supremacy, a telltale sign of the sickness, vicious individualism, a uniquely Western epidemic and export. Individualism is the moral stance, political philosophy, ideology, or social outlook that emphasizes the moral worth of the individual. Individualists promote the exercise of one's goals and desires and so value independence and self-reliance, putting the interests of the individual over precedence over the state or social group, while opposing external influence upon one's interests by society or institutions, such as the government. Individualism makes the individual its focus and so starts with the fundamental premise that the human individual is of primary importance in the struggle for liberation. This principle permeates patriarchal, capitalist, and white supremacist systems and is as American as the 99-cent McDonald's apple pie, which I happen to like. But I digress. So this afternoon, with this and vigilance in mind, I'd like to illuminate a place where this virtue of white supremacy flourishes right beneath our thumbs. I call this talk, "No One Hand Should Have All That Power," or "How Social Media May Not Be So Awesome and Popularizes White Supremacist Individualism." Yeah. Our generation's relationship with social media is complicated, with many tensions and contradictions. This relationship is widely examined as a binary, and most analysis sides with its most positive elements, most heralded as the great connector and community constructor, the democratizer, the voice grantor, and power builder of our age. But I disagree. The cooperative nature of this tool is widely exaggerated, its importance inflated to proportions that threaten to cripple the next generation of liberation fighters. I posit that it has now become an asylum for neoliberal values, an arena where unchecked hate, dominance, farce, and individualism now flourish and threaten to doom our chance at building a mass collective movement of the people. We have reached a point where the hammer is being misrepresented as the house. And many of social media's most talented practitioners have preached embracing it as the pinnacle of representative power and solidarity at the expense of building real community and organization. We live in the age of uploaded avatars, insecurities, and weaknesses in the name of forming community. Social media coddles the individual's expectation for recognition and a false sense of connection through that recognition. Our tangible feelings are lost in the experience of impersonal expression. Even with the ability to reach others at the push of a button, we see many examples of where social media makes us hyper-acclimated to isolation and distance, the very antithesis of the black radical tradition, the village. Thousands, maybe millions of young people are adopting the belief that movement visibility in social media not only guarantees destiny and victory, but also celebrity and awareness with deadly consequences to our movement. The indicators are seditious. Our movement is obsessed with doing the biggest, the most shared thing, and subconsciously lead ourselves into a war against our movement partners. Then there's the cynicism, the searching, the scrolling, and the beat of the thumbs against our devices that soon sour our vision and even influence our strategy. Put simply, we aren't fighting patriarchy, capitalism, or white supremacy. We are vying for virtual validation. This competition is intensely individualistic, apathetic, and naive to the joys of being fully present in a moment, to the sacrifice and commitment that it takes to build a powerful thing that contends with powerful things and transforms relationships to power and destiny. Let us question its distinction as the great democratizer. Unquestionably, it has opened the door for millions of marginalized to be heard and seen by allowing for the stories of scores of once invisible people to be elevated. That is a power previous generations could only hope for. Yet a true democracy weighs both the power of individual identity with the responsibility to the collective. There is no responsibility or accountability in the online arena, save for the Twitter feeding frenzies launched when someone goes afoul of the group thing. There is an anonymity that shields many from the repercussions of their lies and faux leadership, allowing for many to enjoy the fruits of freedom without the labor of accountability. It is this lack of responsibility to a collective, to a community, and unchecked liberalism even within our ranks that created the vacuum that the D. Ray McKessons of the world, individuals crowned leaders by white liberals with no base, no experience, and cobbled analysis, now occupy. His ascendance is the favorite American tale, the story of an individual who, through snark and soundbite and brand alone, can accrue the soft power of influence and online followers, and the very real power to speak for black people. This narrative is happening on our watch and must be challenged. Millions of our youth are internalizing the notion that democracy is the ability to say and do as you please without the responsibility of consequences or to a greater collective than oneself. It is the right-wing pipe dream. A generation of black folk poised to ferociously defend individual liberties under the banners of freedom and democracy that is inherently individualistic and American. Our movement must attack this belief at every turn. Democracy and movement is work. It challenges selfishness and greed and is the building block for an alternative conception of society. We must think of our responsibilities to others in everything that we do and we build. The black radical tradition has always been the champion here, and we must not allow subversive, anti-revolutionary personalities and misleaders to own this conversation any longer. Now to its merit as a great connector and community builder. One would be a fool to ignore the obvious that social media is a virtual passport to places and people worlds away. But what we gain in long-distance connection, I fear we lose in close ones. We've all seen the signs, trains, planes, automobiles, restaurants, and parties filled with people with their eyes transfixed on their palms. Collections of people reduced to insular individuals locked in an ever-expanding digital universe. We find it easier to upload every corner of our consciousness to the web in the name of forming community. And yet we lack the energy and desire to engage in the beautiful black energy around us. Even with this great collective weapon, here we find another example of it being used to make us intensely individual and incapable of empathy and the joys of this beautiful present. Movements and communities are built and sustained through deep personal relationships which challenge dominant narratives of success, opportunism, and supremacist tactics. Social media is a tool towards bringing and building transparent forms of relating and articulation, but cannot replace the work organizers must do in order to demonstrate other modes of positive radical communication. We must continue to challenge the notion. We must continue to create and imagine ways to resolve conflict and affirm each other's voices. We should challenge the notion that social media can do any more than serve as a gateway to organizing in the here and the now. Anything less than a strong on-the-ground accomplice to this virtual reality will surely doom this burgeoning moment nurtured and developed over time. We have to embrace this necessary truth or else fall victim to distraction and deception. Now, let's examine its position as a barometer of a movement's power. There are many definitions of power. To use a concept coined by political scientist Joseph Nye, I propose that social media is an expression of soft power. It is appealing and it is attractive. Culture becomes an ambassador and infiltrates where an individual can become a movement unto oneself without accountability or collective support. It attracts and co-opts instead of coercion. It is a process of lobbying through less transparent channels for political and non-political influence. Social media's power lays in how powerless people are and society becomes more prone to control or persuasion. As organizers, contending with clear and present exertion of a hard power, the use of military and economic means to influence the behavior or interests of our people, we cannot grow comfortable here in our capable wielding of social media soft power. Our opposition relishes our reliance on inherently disconnected online tools and forums to measure, guide, and direct our movement. They crown online leaders. They tried us for a minute. With the obvious goal of co-optation and the subversive goal of teaching our people that those individuals with millions of followers are the drivers of change. More telling, many crown leaders openly advocate against building grassroots organizations in lieu of online engagement and refuge. More sinister, there is a growing fear amongst many liberal circles to contend with and grasp power. This fear has evolved into outright aversion. This activity reveals itself in the actions by many to the direct action tactics of Black Lives Matter and can only be described as counter-revolutionary and anti-movement. Soul is produced through struggle and a resistance to live and become not through the passive witnessing of spectacle and speaking. There is a warmth in our intimacy and sincerity that can only be mocked online, but can never be fully replicated or experienced. Soul is made through the tension of life's obstacles and one's many methods of overcoming. It is what feeds and nourishes us. Now, this analysis comes from personal reflection. For quite some time, social media was my hall of mirrors, judge and jury to my every action and every movement. It inebriated my ego and courted my insecurities. I was off center. My self-perception was self-curated online. If you didn't agree with me, I just followed you, dog. Without it, I began to recognize the little things, the tiny triumphs coming to comfort me in the dark times. I recognized my most vicarious nature, how I use my timeline to escape the stress, isolation, or perceived shortcomings of a present moment. I looked in the mirror and saw my deep desire to be known, remembered, valued. I recognized the lengths I would go to keep hold of social media's illusionary embrace. I was passively skeptical of every performance of resistance I saw on my timeline. Human actions became perverted caricatures. Maybe it was the act of putting the phone face down that forced me to see the people in front of me. Or maybe the silencing of all the commenting that made me listen to the actual voices around me. I could hear my voice more clearly. It was a fasting of the spirit. I was no longer overwhelmed with news feeds of death, pain, politics, and posturing, at least for the time being. I gained some solace from the numbness and cynicism growing from the constant posts on my timeline. I became more connected to the people around me. I actively participated more in everyday events. There was a newness again. I was reunited with the time before we knew what everyone ate, who everyone loved, where they vacationed, how their day went, all before meeting them. I was meeting people outside of other people's interest in them. There was a warmth returned to me again. There was an empathy returned to me again. How many of you all know it's unnatural to watch people die every day? How many of you all know it's unnatural for a human being to scroll past pictures that we see every day? You know, three, four years ago, I'm from West Englewood, Chicago. Arguably the worst part of the murder capital of the country. And the first time I saw somebody die was in 2005 when I watched the death of Martin Lee Anderson at the hands of prison guards. And it shook me. It's the reason that I'm a part of any movement today. What I saw almost 10 years ago when I went into a room of other college activists and realized that there was a murderous regime running our state, and that they would kill somebody and say that it was because of medical causes, a spontaneous spurring of sickle cell anemia, that Negro disease that no one knew he had until that very moment, but we captured it on tape, six grown men beating a young child to death. And almost 10 years ago, that fucked my day up, that fucked my life up. And now 10 years later, we could scroll by it, right? 10 years later, you could say, I saw that video already. 10 years later, you could see a child on the beach and keep it moving. Empathy is dying, right? And so we've gotta work to rescue a generation that knows what death looks like and is comfortable with it. Because without empathy, we can't build a movement. So what is our duty as a movement in challenging this? We must build organizations, actions, and practices that have mass educational appeal and also transform intimate relational presence or engagement. Our movement must return the collective to its rightful place in our analysis, practice, and vision for a better tomorrow. I encourage our community organizers towards true exhibitions of democracy, community, power, and the collective, not fellowship and diffusions of responsibility. We must ferociously challenge the notion that any one of us is more important than all of us. We must re-embrace the great strategic value in everyone not knowing everything you do, when you do it, and whom you do it with. A side note, we have been conditioned to be complicit in compromising our best strategies, delivering all of our plans publicly. We must envision new strategies in this surveillance state reality. Do some misinformation. Tag yourself somewhere and then leave your phone and then go somewhere else. Just mess them all the way up. Right? Just say, oh, I'm with Angela Davis in the crib. She's not here, but just mess them up. We must wrest our movement from the clutches of individualism and the false message of microwave movement. A movement can be educated and invigorated online, but never built there. A true movement is one based on deep relationships that can withstand the winds of trend. We have all watched cyber solidarity and camaraderie drown in the shallow waters of online connections. Y'all know what I'm talking about, right? Okay. Building relationships with people requires being present. Nothing, no amount of speeches, witty tweets, shirts, appearances, protest pictures with your fist up can replace that. Dr. King speaks from the grave. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. I challenge us all to bask in the magic of the here and now. Reserve precious moments for only your memory. Implore our communities to reunite with all of their many selves, not just the avatar with the most likes. We must remind our movement of the magic of collective community. We must get lost in conversation with our innermost thoughts and idiosyncrasies. We must seek out the whys and the how longs and once again be amazed and a little bit embarrassed at ourselves. We must remember a time where love was a warm embrace, liberation a hot meal with comrades in the kitchen and a song in the heart, and victory more than headlines. Then and only then, will we challenge subversive cyber white supremacy and truly hold a united future in the palm of our hands?
That was Umi Saleh, formerly known as Philip Agnew of the Dream Defenders. Jamala Rogers is a veteran organizer based in Missouri and author of the new book, Ferguson is America, Roots of Rebellion.
I really wanted to focus on our movement, because if we're going to fight anything, whether it's white supremacy, neoliberalism, capitalism, our movement's got to be something different. Our movement has got to be something stronger. And I can tell you, after Ferguson, we saw a lot. We experienced a lot. We felt a lot. And all of it wasn't good, y'all. So in some ways, we are moving, but we are still recuperating from some of the unprincipledness that dropped in on us, that is still usurping the energies of brothers and sisters who were there before August 9th, and they're going to be there after August 9th. And so those voices of young people have to be lifted up. And I'm actually prepared and more committed to doing that than I ever have been. The Ferguson effect often is referred to as policing not being able to do their jobs, that somehow they're now scared to police because they're under such public scrutiny. Well, we knew that was a lie in Ferguson, because less than 2 weeks after Mike Brown was shot, Jimmy Powell was shot. And that was with the whole world, cameras and all, international media there. So we know that that's a crock. What I'm calling the Ferguson effect is the unapologetic way that not just young people, But black people are moving and grooving in all arenas. Yeah. So I call the Ferguson effect the fact that black Rams players come out with hands up. That ain't never been done before. I'm calling the Ferguson effect the fact that Black Lives Matter activists snatch microphones out of the presidential candidate's hands. That's what I'm calling the Ferguson effect. I'm calling the Ferguson effect the fact that black folks in Chicago refused to stand down until they got the resignation of the police chief, corrupt as he was. That's the Ferguson effect for real, y'all. We are doing things and feeling things that we've never felt before. And that's good. That's good. And we got to keep that going. And I know that sometimes this gets said in a historical way, that this is the only time we got to get it together. It's not. We've been here before. But this is certainly some exciting times that we're in. All kind of possibilities are opening up. And I really am proud to be a part of the movement right now. I was listening to Sister Africa, Pam Africa, and I really could feel something from her. And probably it's an age thing. This year is going to be like 50 years I've been in this movement. And I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that for accolades, because it ain't, you know, my life ain't been no crystal stair, y'all. But what I am saying is that when you've been doing this for 50 years, you've seen a lot. You've seen our people suffer. You've seen death in the streets, literally people dying in the streets. You've been a part of the crack cocaine epidemic, which I call chemical warfare on our people. You witnessed, and not only you witnessed that, and this is the thing that I think we need to be mindful of, that you were a part of trying to steer some of that stuff. You were part of trying to save some lives. You were not a spectator in what was going on. And I think right now some of us are spectators. I'm just going to bring it to you straight, y'all, because y'all didn't ask me to come all this way to bullshit you, right? So when I talk about the fact that we saw things in Ferguson, we felt things in Ferguson, some of that was learning stuff, you know, that, you know, some young people had never experienced before. They didn't think it was going to happen like that. They didn't think it was going to take that long to get the attention of the white supremacist government there. But there was so much that we did learn. There are so many young people who've been truly radicalized. And they are now coming in conflict with young people who have a different agenda. I'm just going to say it like that. So one of the things I've been challenging young people to do, and everybody to do, is to think about, we are wanting to hold the folks in power accountable, but we don't hold ourselves accountable. Some of our organizations are mirroring some of these neoliberal organizations. And we don't see anything wrong with that. The only difference is we got a fancy radical sounding name on the door. But the same hierarchical, privileged staffing that goes on in corporate America goes down in those organizations. These are the organizations that are fighting for justice, y'all. How are we going to do that and win? How is the Black Lives Matter going to move forward when there's young women of color, black, trans, queer women, and when you start to acknowledge that, you hear grumblings from brothers that are supposed to be radical? Just because we have the rhetoric, the external trappings, a nice t-shirt, a mud cloth hat, doesn't mean that the same hegemonic toxins don't affect us. They do. And we for some reason that don't feel like it, they do. So we've been struggling with some brothers around their misogyny for a long time. Why? We've been struggling with some of our anti-racist white allies for a long time. Why? A little call and response there, I like that. Yeah. That's the why that I think we gotta really delve into. Because if we don't do that, y'all, this is the vanguard. And I say this with no amount of blowing smoke up people's butts, but some of the smartest people I know are in the movement. They're in the movement, thank goodness. So why can't we figure this stuff out, y'all? It's because we don't take this stuff seriously. We don't take the fact that these folks got a plan, and they've been working their plan for a very long time. And I can say that because when I say 50 years, one of the things I remember is back in 1972, I did a congressional hearing for our first black congressman. And it was around disinvestment. It was around of our communities. We had come across something called the Team 4 plan that was supposed to be hitting, where there was concentrated disinvestment of parts of our communities, starting with major institutions like schools and hospitals. 40 years later, his son, who's a congressperson, asked me to testify at a hearing on the same damn thing. So they're moving ahead with a plan, y'all, but we seem to be in some kind of virtual loop here. And we got to get ourselves out of it. And we got to get out quick, because when we saw Ferguson, we saw what they had in store for us. We hadn't seen it before. We knew they had, like, guns. We didn't know they were coming out with MRAPs and drones and all of that. So now we know they ain't playing with us. So here are some of the questions that I really want to put forward for us to think about. Because I think, you know, we doing this in love. Although I do tell some people, if you don't learn quick, we're going to move to the next level. But we got to do it in love, y'all. And sometimes we need to stay off Twitter when we're having our debates. I tell young people, you can't have a principal debate in 144 characters. You can't. 140. Okay, 140. I stand corrected. And I stand corrected by somebody whose organization did something different. And he didn't know I was going to say this, but I've already been talking about it. They did a social media blackout. Because what they were finding out was that they were spending more time with checking out who's liking their tweets and retweeting than fighting against patriarchy and capitalism. They were seeking virtual validation when our people are suffering. I really commend y'all for that. I'm serious. When I saw that, I'm like, a lot of times we do this broad brush stroke with the millennials. I'm like, well, hold up. Well, here's an example. Here's something that's positive and good. A step back to say, what are we doing? What is our purpose here? Is this what it's all about? Because I don't care. If you got 5 million followers and they ain't doing jack, I'd rather have 100 people follow me that are clear on their purpose and direction. So let's not get it twisted with Twitter, because they racist too, y'all. Check out how many black people work for them. So here's a question that we're going to think about while we're having this discussion. Where are the working class leaders that we are developing as a movement? There are at least 5 areas that our people are really suffering in. And these are called quality of life areas, where if you don't have them, your quality of life is going to be diminished. So when I look at the fact that the public education has been under attack for a while, but what's really left in public schools, I ain't talking about like charter magnet and all of that. I'm talking about the real public schools are the kids that are coming from intergenerational chronic poverty who've been abused sexually, physically, mentally, and physically. These are the kids that are crowded into a classroom to learn. I'm going to tell y'all that I don't see a black agenda there. I don't see black radicals there. I think the sister just talked about it, Reverend Pam, that she needs to see some of y'all. I don't see folks out there doing that. In the struggle for public health, most cities that we're in, there are no more public hospitals. Our people are dying, literally. There's no radical agenda for that. In terms of housing, of course, you can forget public housing. And you think about some place like New York City where on any given day 60,000 people are homeless. That's a city, y'all. Y'all really have this many people that is? We don't have a radical agenda for that, y'all. And no radicals up in there. When I say no, don't somebody say, oh, I know somebody that's doing housing work. I'm talking about en masse, we have no agenda in that area. When I think about the state repression, what organizations do we have that are fighting police terror? And even though we victimize every day and we being killed every 28 hours, Malcolm X grassroots people told us that, we still don't have an agenda, y'all. Even around mass incarceration, don't y'all say, Sister Angela David, okay, that's one person. Where is our radical black agenda around mass incarceration? So we got some work, y'all. There's no radical agenda in those areas that we can be working in, that we can provide a framework for folks who are coming in. And we're seeing lots of folks come in new. They're saying, what should I do? Where should I go? But there's no theoretical framework for them, no radical guidance. The other questions. Where is the evidence of our organizing for political and economic power? And when I say that, I'm not just talking about the electoral arena. I'm talking about how are we organizing our people, working class people, for real power? It's not happening, y'all. Not the way it should. Where is the popular or political education of the masses of people so that they aren't calling for more police, more surveillance cameras, or in some cases, being part of the gentrification effort? That's about education, y'all. If we're not doing that and tell people, no, we don't need any more cameras. We don't need surveillance cameras. That doesn't stop crime. All that's going to do is put Miss Angela's kids in the jail. That you know, this is what happened during the crack cocaine epidemic. When we said, we don't care what y'all do with them, just get them out of here. And they did. They did. Over a million of us in those cages now.
Longtime organizer Jamala Rogers, whose new book is titled Ferguson is America, Roots of Rebellion. Robin DJ Kelly rounded out the panel on challenging white supremacy at the conference on the Black Radical Tradition. Kelly is a veteran activist and public intellectual who teaches history at UCLA.
I want to argue that the post-racial era that a lot of us joke about is, you know, is no joke at all. But in fact, the latest manifestations of white supremacy. And I think, you know, David Theo Goldberg has his book called Are We Post-Racial Yet? And I think he's right when he argues that the post-racial represents a neoliberalization of race, the upending of that brief period of multiculturalism and diversity, which we think of as the golden age, but I will argue was not. Now, we all know that how Obama's election is held up as evidence of the post-racial era. And no one in this room really believes that that's true, that his election represents the post-racial era. At least most black people don't. But what most of us don't always challenge is the assertion that Obama's election represents the civil rights movement's crowning achievement. They may disagree with Obama, but they say, well, it's economy. And then they will go back. They'll say, Shirley Chisholm's campaign, Jesse Jackson campaign, all these bids for Democratic nominations were the stepping stones on the long road toward progress. And then we say, well, Obama just disappointed us. I think that's not true. I think it's much deeper than that. On the one hand, there is some truth in the fact that the civil rights movement did help make his election possible by fighting to expand the electorate for all. We see this in the Chisholm campaigns and Jackson campaigns, which in Jackson campaign, by the way, helped elect Bill Clinton, because all that voter registration made that possible. And Clinton, of course, is one of the worst disasters. On the other hand, what also secured Obama's election, however, was the very collapse of the movement, its retreat from the radical agenda of SNCC, of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, of the Negro American Labor Council, of the Civil Rights Congress, as well as the Black Panther Party, the National Welfare Rights Organization, and I could go on. And the destruction of the movement's radical elements, you know, was partly achieved by the very national security state our president has spent a lot of political capital to expand and defend. In other words, I want to argue that Obama's election and the emergence of a black neoliberal political class represents a betrayal of the principles basic to the black freedom movement, to the anti-war movement, to left feminist movements. Okay. And so we're talking about a commander-in-chief famous for escalating drone warfare, targeted assassinations. I mean, I could go on. You know that story. We know that this is a president that oversees the largest secret domestic surveillance program in the U.S., who extended the National Defense Authorization Act, whose regime deported more undocumented workers than any previous administration before that, a regime that bailed out Wall Street while victims of the financial sector excesses lost their homes, jobs, and savings. We heard about that today. A regime whose Justice Department is now critical of militarizing local police departments had actually increased funding for the BURN program, which provides money for armored vehicles, SWAT armor, surveillance drones, helicopters, et cetera, to ramp up the war on drugs, right? My point is not to indict Obama the person. I'm sure he's a perfectly nice person. But to talk about the temporary, and I say temporary, I got to underscore that, the temporary defeat of the black radical movement, even as they attributed their ideology of colorblindness to the very movement they destroyed. But let's just jump back real quickly to 1963, the March on Washington. Again, by now, no one in this room really believes that that march was, you know, about promoting a dream of black and white children playing together. At its core, it was about economic justice. The brainchild behind it both had roots in socialist and labor movements, Bayard Rustin, a veteran black labor leader, and A. Philip Randolph, who threatened a similar march two decades earlier. Randolph, in his rarely cited speech, warned, quote, "We have no future in a society in which 6 million black and white people are unemployed and millions more live in poverty. Nor is the goal of our civil rights revolution merely the passage of civil rights legislation. Yes, we want all public accommodations open to all citizens, but those accommodations will mean little to those who cannot afford to use them. Yes, we want a Fair Employment Practice Act, but what good will it do if profit-geared automation destroys the jobs of millions of workers, black and white?" Remember, in 63, violence was the major theme. And in fact, I would argue that state violence and vigilante violence is what brought most people to the movement. Think about the context. The context was in that spring, all those images of Ingram Park in Birmingham and dogs and water hoses and basically a kind of local police force attacking black people. That was the image projected on television, the image that brought people to Washington, D.C. The murders of Herbert Lee and Medgar Evers in Mississippi, the attacks on voter registration activists. And keep in mind that August 28th wasn't picked by accident. August 28th was picked because it was the 8th anniversary of the murder of Emmett Till, right? So murder, death, violence was central. It wasn't just integrating, you know, restaurants. So what happened to this vision of economic justice and ending state and vigilante violence? Well, several things. First, all the big groups SDLC, CORE, NAACP, Urban League, they threw their energies almost entirely behind passing a watered-down civil rights bill and supporting the voting rights bill under President Johnson. In other words, they focused on influencing the Democratic Party. Second, the labor movement betrayed the coalition's racial justice agenda. Rank-and-file white members worried that the elimination of racial barriers to equal wages, access to skilled jobs, and unfettered access to housing would threaten their privileged status. And third, Randolph and other leaders deliberately excluded black women's organizations from playing any significant role in the movement. Why is that significant? Because this weakened the coalition, in part because activists like Pauli Murray, Anna Hedgman, Dorothy Robinson, Dorothy Height had already committed to linking labor and economic justice questions to racial and gender equality. So you cut them out, then they're not going to be part, a central part of the ideology driving that agenda. But this did not mean it was the end of the radical position. On the contrary, in the decade following the March on Washington, many black organizations like SNCC and Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party not only embraced a program of economic justice, but went further, calling for the redistribution of wealth, reparations, workers' power, and an end to U.S. imperialism. Now, we think that this stuff is so new. This is like 1963. I mean, you know, many black organizations like SNCC and, in 1963, SNCC waged its Freedom Vote campaign in Mississippi. And we know about it. You see it in Eyes on the Prize. It's about people putting ballots that don't really mean anything except they're symbolic, supposedly. But what we don't always pay attention to was the platform. The platform of the Freedom Vote campaign included the right of labor to organize. The right of labor to engage in collective bargaining. This is Mississippi. A minimum wage of $1.25, 500 acres, and tax exemption for anyone with plots smaller than that. 5 years later, the same Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, who we think, from if you watch enough documentaries, think died in 1964, had the most radical plank in the country. They're calling for guaranteed annual income, an extended daycare for poor and working mothers, comprehensive medical care for all, increased federal provisions for food stamp programs, free higher education. People talking about they want tuition reductions. Free higher education for all, and an end to the draft, full military withdrawal from Vietnam, renewed diplomatic ties with Cuba and China, an arms embargo on South Africa and Israel. So, in other words, economic justice, self-defense, and protection from state and vigilante violence, racial and sexual violence, were key issues taken up by groups as diverse as the National Welfare Rights Organization, the Poor People's Campaign, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, Black Workers Congress, the Young Lords, the Panthers, the Combahee River Collective, NOW, the National Black Feminist Organization, the National Abortion Rights Action. Now, whatever their flaws and contradictions, all these organizations and movements built on aspects of a radical democratic vision, which you can argue goes back to Reconstruction, but I don't have time to go into that. Meanwhile, as all these struggles against racial capitalism, war, and patriarchy are ramping up, there is a global slump in the 70s that opened the door for an expansion of neoliberal policies already being implemented in the Global South. And if you were here this morning for the amazing panel, Vijay Prashad laid out this story, and I'm not going to go into it, I don't need to repeat it, but if it's podcast, go check it out and read his book, The Poorer Nations. Read all his books, by the way, every single thing he's ever written. In the U.S., the economic crisis produced unemployment, trade deficits, deepened third world debt as well, and fueled capital flight. Workers responded in the 70s with a wave of strikes in this period, further justifying an attack on labor, as well as claims that capital needed to go places where there were no unions and less regulation. I mean, think about what it means in this age where unions are considered to be the villain. You know, a problem for it was always a problem for capital, but a problem for the workers themselves. And that wasn't the case in the 70s. It opens the door for privatizing public assets, for the devolution of the welfare state, for prison expansion, for remaking the tax code to benefit the rich. And of course, you got to keep in mind that this is not about Republicans. This is across the board, Carter administration, all of them. They pushed for tax reductions, they cut back on social spending, implemented austerity measures, expanded military presence, not just around the globe, but they also militarized the U.S. border with Mexico in this period, and other things which was talked about this morning. Finally, just to turn to one other thing, in response to resistance to racism, militarism, and an economic catastrophe in the 70s, and by the way, the 70s was one of the most dynamic periods of struggle. We don't think about that because we're convinced by, you know, television that somehow everything ended in 1968. I don't know why that. Stop watching television. In any case, you know, the U.S. was steadily selling the nation and the world this narrative that Obama repeats every chance he gets, and that is that America succeeded in dismantling Jim Crow. This is the post-civil rights era, that this is the great success, that we had racism and we got rid of it. And even if they say, well, we have racism, but now we don't have formal Jim Crow. But, you know, so what ends up happening in the post-civil rights era is that in place of this narrative is multiculturalism. So remember that the original evidence was not Obama's election. The evidence that we reached the post-civil rights and post-racial era was not Obama's election, but the ruling class's embrace of multiculturalism, diversity, and inclusion. That is the language of racial liberalism from the 70s until now. And we often think of this as a victory, when it could be argued that it was part of the defeat of the movement. Multiculturalism and diversity policies and discourse do not disrupt white supremacy.
Yes.
Not. Now, what is true is that they were responses to genuine struggles waged by the Black Freedom Movement and other oppressed groups in the 60s and 70s, but the adoption of diversity, inclusion, multiculturalism co-opted a radical movement demanding the complete transformation of the social order and the eradication of all forms of racial, gender, sexual, and class hierarchies. The point of liberal multiculturalism was not to address the historical legacies of racism, dispossession, and injustice, but to bring some people into the fold of a society no longer seen as racially unjust. What are the results? Well, Black elected officials and Black CEOs who help manage the great transfer of wealth to the rich, who oversee the continued erosion of the welfare state and the environment, the displacement and deterioration of Black and brown communities and mass incarceration and wage war on the planet. You know, we heard this from Glenn Ford this morning. I don't need to repeat that. We're talking about breaking glass ceilings in corporate America while building more jail cells for the rest. You know, we also witnessed a shift away from a radical anti-capitalist critique to a politics of recognition. And I'm reminded of Adolf Reed's 1979 essay, Black Particularity Reconsidered, which demonstrated that the state and the dominant class had no problems incorporating Black people into the existing state apparatus. A politics of recognition means the right to same-sex marriage based on the same principles of marriage as a property relation. It also means the right of people of color, of women, of queer people to kill and torture around the world. That's not the politics that we want. A radical critique of racial capitalism requires going to the root in order to illuminate what is hidden from us. Structures of oppression are simply not visible. If they were visible, then it would be kind of easy to attack. If we argue, for example, that state violence is merely a manifestation of anti-blackness because that is what we see and feel, we are left with no theory of the state. And we have no way of understanding racialized police violence in places like Atlanta and Detroit, where most cops are Black, unless we turn to some metaphysical explanations. What are the lessons? Well, we cannot wage an assault on white supremacy without fighting to end capitalism. And by capitalism, I mean everything. I mean it's fetishism of commodities, it's law of private property, it's gendered logics, it's bourgeois individualism, it's culture, it's state apparatus. Racial capitalism can and has conceded to demands for inclusion. But to paraphrase Malcolm, why should you want inclusion in a burning house? Yes. So, So when our movements demand recognition or think cultural competency training or more black authors in the curriculum or more black administrators or more black cops or more liberal education will dismantle white supremacy, they are sorely mistaken. Yes, the answer is that we still need to continue to fight, and that we will do. But we need new analyses that can get to the root of our oppressions as well as the possibility of its negation, which is to say our liberation. And to quote my comrade Vijay Prashad, quoting Amilcar Cabral, tell no lies, claim no easy victories.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.